I'm going to, we won't start taping it, well, I suppose we could. I want to mention some books while we're waiting for the rest to get here. And I want to pass around one, which in fact I got at this bookstore in a fit of weakness. I don't like to buy big paperbacks and carry them back. But this is one gem. And many of you might already know it. It's Harper's Anthology of 20th Century Native American Poetry. And it is really an interesting collection. And I will be passing around some sheets today, all of which I'll need back for the sake of the trees. But on the sheets, you'll see reference to another anthology of poetry called Early Ripening Now, which is an anthology of contemporary women's poetry that's American, U.S., and a very, very good collection. I recommended yesterday, I can't remember now, Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. It's over in the bookstore, and if you need a good novel, it's a wonderful novel in its own right and also a background for Alice Walker. But there is another novel there that I only recently became acquainted with and read for the Women's Theological Center, and that's Ceremony by Leslie Silko. Anybody read that? A Native American contemporary poet. And there are still a couple of copies left, but it is a stunningly good novel. It's an anti-war novel about Southwest, actually Navajo. So, Leslie Silko, S-I-L-K-O, and she has a new novel out, which I haven't read, and of course I don't remember the name of it either.
Almanac of the Dead.
Almanac of the Dead, thanks. Have you read it?
No, Rick read it. I looked at it. It was too thick.
A friend of mine is, in fact, Donna Bibbins, the co-director of the Women's Theological Center, is reading it, and she says it's the review said it was tremendously depressing and nonetheless essential reading, so I haven't heard yet from Donna what she thinks of it. And I want also to mention the book there by Ruth Duck called Gender and the Name of God. If you're at all interested in God language questions, Ruth Duck has written what is close to the currently definitive work on this issue. And she takes up some interesting critiques of Joachim Jeremias. He's a dead scholar. But he got us into this notion that Jesus' favorite name for God was Father. And the current scholarship that Ruth uses in that book shows that this is just not true. That's an interesting address of some God talk issues. Now, I would like to inform you a bit about the structure for this 1 hour, and I'm afraid I can already tell it's going to be tight. So let's start taping. This is the fourth session on theology and art, and this session is on poetry as a means of discerning the holy. I'd like to begin by reading two poems, not for our discussion, but simply to set our brain synapses, to get out of prose electron flow and into poetry. These are two poems by what must be my currently most favoritist poet, and that is Mary Oliver. Any of you know her work, any chance? I'm going to recommend to Jeanette to get some copies of some of her work here because it fits Holden marvelously. The first one I want to read is a short poem called The Summer Day, which certainly fit this morning and fit last night's forum. And after I read these poems, I'll make some comments about a theme that has been running through these sessions all week, and then we'll look at five poems together. I have copies to share of those poems, so we'll read them out loud and then discuss them. The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? That question is a good question to begin hearing, thinking some poetry. The second poem is called Morning Poem, and it is another poem in which Mary Oliver considers both prayer and nature together, which is a theme we've been working at this week in various of the sessions of the Elder Hostel as well. This is called Morning Poem. Every morning the world is created. Under the orange sticks of the sun, the heaped ashes of the night turn into leaves again and fasten themselves to the high branches, and the ponds appear like black cloth on which are painted islands of summer lilies. If it is your nature to be happy, you will swim away along the soft trails for hours, your imagination alighting everywhere. And if your spirit carries within it the thorn that is heavier than lead, if it's all you can do to keep on trudging, there is still somewhere deep within you a beast shouting that the earth is exactly what it wanted. Each pond with its blazing lilies is a prayer heard and answered lavishly every morning, whether or not you have ever dared to be happy, whether or not you have ever dared to pray. Those poems, by the way, of introduction, and I want to make now some brief prose comments about a theme that I have understood to be running through our work this week. In the Alice Walker short story with which we began on Monday, the figure of Jesus was a key figure in the story, walking the road with the old woman. And in the Flannery O'Connor short story, Why Do the Heathen Rage?, Jesus showed up at the end, surprising the mother, as the general with the sword in his mouth, marching to do violence. And already we had two very different pictures of Jesus in just those two short stories. Yesterday, we talked, I talked a bit, and others listened, about Mapplethorpe's Easter Lilies, a Jesus Resurrection work of art and photography, and Andres Serrano's Piss Christ, a contemporary photograph, again, of the crucifixion with the corpus on the crucifix. It has occurred to me, even since yesterday's session, actually, that the dress form about which I talked was had a dimension which I didn't realize when I first saw the exhibit. The freestanding sculpture of the dress form, covered with flank steak and sewn together like a dress, actually could be understood as another form of the cross. And the crucifixion of women in certain understandings of body in this culture would fit nicely with this theme moving along, because I don't understand the Christ to be exclusively male in my theology. That is, the Christ who is resurrected is much more than simply an incarnate male body. In my own photography, I alluded to my use of spirals as an attempt to articulate in visual terms an understanding of the infinite. I have at other times talked about it explicitly as Sophia and Christa, using the feminine form of the Christ. I'm a great fan of Joe Sittler's cosmic Christology, that is an understanding of Christ which is much bigger than Nazareth and much bigger than Lutheran. Joel Sittler was never very popular in Lutheran circles in the United States with his understanding of this Christ resurrected, crucified, simultaneously pervading the universe. But I like that Christology a lot. And I hope in some of my photography increasingly to be able to represent what I understand affectively and intellectually that cosmic Christ to be about. But if Christ were only about Sophia and spirals, we'd be impoverished, I think. So the basic question is, who is Jesus of Nazareth? Who is Jesus the Christ? And so far, in my feminist methodology of accumulation of data rather than exclusion of heresy or falsehood right from the start, in my methodology of accumulation, I think so far it has, in the works of art we've looked at or heard, it has been clear that Jesus can be the liberator. And I would use a phrase that I thought of up in the third level at about 6 o'clock this morning in another context. And that is the image of liberator as saturated colored power. That seems to fit nicely with the kind of Jesus who is the general with the sword cutting through hypocrisy, racism, and crap. But at the same time that Jesus is that kind of liberator, Jesus is intimate friend who is crucified. A lot of Lutheran Orthodox piety is very much afraid of talking about Jesus in intimate terms and in terms of friendship, fearing to reduce somehow Jesus to romanticized piety. But I think in Lutheran circles in the United States and other Protestant as well, we have a lot to learn about intimate friendship as a metaphor of Jesus the Christ or the holy if one is not Christian. Jesus in these stories was also the old Negro woman. I think Mark helped us nicely at the end of that discussion, showing that Jesus was not only Jesus walking down the road, but Jesus, the Christ, was also the figure of the old woman herself. At the same time that Jesus is the old Negro woman, Jesus is also the gay men portrayed in Mapplethorpe's photography, including the homoerotic explicit photography. So this is a Christology which doesn't reduce or exclude, but it understands the corporate nature of the resurrected Christ to be so complex that you have constantly to name all the particularities of human experience and other than human experience in order to understand this focus of the holy. So today I want to make the transition to the poems we'll consider by using one more poem about Jesus explicitly, and that's another Mary Oliver poem. It's a poem which has bothered me immensely, in the good sense, but it's bothered me in part because it draws on the Sea of Galilee story, and we haven't yet found who ripped off that wonderful Rembrandt painting from the museum in Boston, from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum a couple of years ago. There's this huge Rembrandt painting of the waves in the Sea of Galilee, just tumultuous, and somebody's got it. They're too poor to offer big rewards, so who knows. But this poem picks up on this image, and I was struck again by it the other day in a current exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts, which has a work of art. It's in a series called Handcrafted and Outspoken, a very, very different kinds of artworks. But there's one which is almost as big as this whole end wall. And it's a series of prints, identical prints, of soldiers from the Gulf War, just showing their heads and helmets. But interspersed about three rows up from the bottom is another series of prints, which is Haitian refugees falling out of a boat and still in a boat, modeled after Rembrandt's painting of Jesus in the Sea of Galilee. So it's a very sharp disjunction in that work of art of one war fought for liberation and the same administration preventing those seeking liberation from coming to these shores. So this first poem in the series that we'll look at, I won't pass it out, I'll just read this one and then pass out the others. This one is called Maybe by Mary Oliver. Sweet Jesus, talking his melancholy madness, stood up in the boat and the sea lay down, silky and sorry. So everybody was saved that night, But you know how it is when something different crosses the threshold. The uncles mutter together. The women walk away. The young brother begins to sharpen his knife. Nobody knows what the soul is. It comes and goes like the wind over the water. Sometimes for days you don't think of it. Maybe after the sermon, after the multitude was fed, one or two of them felt the soul slip forth like a tremor of pure sunlight before exhaustion that wants to swallow everything gripped their bones and left them miserable and sleepy, as they are now, forgetting how the wind tore at the sails before he rose and talked to it, tender and luminous and demanding as he always was, a thousand times more frightening than the killer sea. I want to come back to that at the very end. You will have detected that one of the fascinations of my theological working these days is the connection of Jesus and violence, on which we need to do a lot of work, in part for SWAPO, but also for ourselves. So now I'd like to use a set of poems. I think, in fact, I might skip the first one. It's another Mary Oliver, but we're going to run out of time, and I want to spend most of the time on one by Joy Harjo. So indeed, I'm going to skip the Alice Walker, too. We'll start with one called House from the Street by Lisa Weiss. So I don't want to do all the talking at all. If you would share these, there are about 10 copies, so a little more than two persons on one should do it. And you might want to follow along or not, as you please. I'm going to read it out loud. And then ask you for any reaction to this poem. I'll use three poems, and they all have one underlying, they all have one theme in common among many, and that's the theme that I want us to focus on. If it doesn't come out in discussion, I'll highlight it myself. So this is Houston Street, which is in Manhattan, of course. They huddle over garbage fires, moving from foot to foot, heat passing quickly through their rags. They gulp coffee, gleaned from the pockets of passers-by, fresh from showers, where hot water is never a miracle, from homes where thick rolls of toilet paper are never luxuries. They never ask me for money. Something uncertain in my newly leathered feet tells them, something uncertain in the way I clutch my morning token tells them there is a thin line between us. We are not busy people, hurrying to breakfast in steamy cafes, to offices where coffee perks all day. In the evening, a man in a Playboy hat, face down in the gutter, empty bottles, pools of puke, the one-legged man still hustling to polish windshields. A man on a stoop asks me for a cigarette. I see my brother in his broken teeth, matted hair. My groceries grow heavy in my arms. He asks me to marry him, the only man who ever dared. I laugh and wink. He knows, I know, how these greasy streets feel to cold, bare feet. We both know how quickly the fine line between us melts. Any initial reaction to that poem? And there are no right or wrong reactions, so whatever strikes you.
Just the connection between her and these people on the street, I wonder what it is that they both know. You know, she obviously is not on the street, and I don't know if she has been, but that's just kind of an initial thing I wonder about.
Any clues in the poem as to how recently she might have been there? And anybody can... There's one...
Newly leathered feet.
Newly leathered feet. There's an earlier one, too. It's the line, even right before that, something uncertain in my newly leathered feet. In other words, it reinforces that this is not her customary clothing. Anything else about the poem? Do you like the last line? The last two lines? How quickly the fine line between us melts?
Well, it impressed me because I've been living in Washington, D.C. for the last 3 years, and I realized as I walked through the city and there are so many homeless, that this just struck me a few weeks ago, that I notice places in the city and think in my mind, if I were homeless, I'd come here to sleep. And I noticed that no one's there, and why not? And one day I thought, why am I doing this? You know, considering places for myself to go someday when I'm homeless. And so this idea of the fine line has occurred, I guess, in my mind at a lot of different levels every time I've been there. More so than in a place like this or where I came from. So.
Mm-hmm. I know one of my greatest fears for my whole life has been ending up as a bag lady. And it's kind of like my greatest fear that someday that might happen to me.
You say for your whole life. Is that do you know why? I mean, not many of us are at the age of six, I think, of fearing to be bag ladies, but
well, I did grow up in upper middle class Americana, so I guess that might be part of it, but somehow, you know that in order to get all these things you have to follow the rules. And I think there was part of me that was pretty early decided that I didn't like the rules, and I was afraid because of that I'd end up on the street.
How would you feel about being busy people who have breakfast in steamy cafes and offices where coffee perks all days and where toilet paper is always available? Is that a preferable life for you?
Well, it would be preferable to be comfortable. Yeah.
Yeah. I first read this poem after my income dropped from 36,000 to 10,000. It was a rather, I liked it. Liked it a lot, in fact. I actually read the poem Sunrise by Mary Oliver at the same time, which I won't read now, but it has the same theme that the divisions between individual people are nowhere near as sharp as affluent white middle-class America likes to think. Now, there's another poem that isn't quite on the same theme, but near, and I'll pass that, pass copies to the edges here. And I would like these copies back, just to repeat that again.
Can I say something about that last line while we move the cut out?
Yeah. Oh my goodness, I didn't realize that. Is this the one third of the Trinity above us? Welcome, Jen.
Comfortable up here. I read that last line as a double entendre.
In what sense?
That's what I like about it. It's disturbing and shocking and wonderfully hopeful somehow. And it reminds me of many, many moments on the streets of New York, but two or three in particular, when I felt that fine line melt, knowing very well how very privileged I am. Still, there were wonderful connections with homeless people. Absolutely in passing, that seemed real to me, even though I'm sure that my perspective is distorted by my privilege somehow. But when a human connection was made, it had nothing to do, in a couple of cases, even with the exchange of money. It was just two people on the street being people. Mm-hmm. And sounds sentimental, but that really does happen in New York.
Yeah.
And the fine line melts, and the wink, and all of that. Please.
And let's put aside for a second the adjective of sentimental. It might sound sentimental, but let's not grant that. Let's wait to see if we can, toward the end of this, find another adjective for this experience of the fine line melting. Because there's it's a theme in the next two poems as well, but from a very different angle. This is The House That Fear Built, Warsaw, 1943, by Jane Flanders. The purpose of poetry is to remind us how difficult it is to remain just one person. For our house is open, there are no keys in the doors. It's a poem from a poem by Czesław Miłosz, who writes some wonderful poetry himself. I am the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the woman with lowered gaze who fears the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the man in the overcoat who loves the woman with lowered gaze, who fears the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. I am the stranger who photographs the man in the overcoat who loves the woman with lowered gaze, who fears the soldier whose rifle is trained on the boy with his hands raised over his head in Warsaw. The crowd of which I am each part moves on beneath my window, for I am the crone too who shakes her sheets over every street in the world, muttering, "What's this? What's this?" So, initial reactions to that one. Do you see the connection with the previous poem, Holliston Street? What are they both saying?
I wonder who the I is, and if it is a general I, I mean an I for all of us. I mean, this is the fine line melting, you know, all these people are, I mean, everyone is connected somehow.
Do you like being every I, every person that this I is?
In some ways, you know, it'd be, I mean, because there's so much in my life where, you know, that I've kind of channeled into these ideas of who I have to be, or, you know, as a, I don't know, a white male, or just different parts of my life, I'm supposed to be different things, and sometimes it'd be nice to be an old woman in Warsaw, or, you know, or just, you know, the, I guess I like it.
Do you like being every one of these?
Not this boy, or the soldier. I guess none of them, you know, in some ways none of them would be good to be. Because they're all places of fear.
Mm-hmm. What is the poem built on? What does it remind you of, structurally?
House that Jack built.
Yeah, this is the house that Jack built. How many of you learned that as children? There might be a generational thing there, at least some. So it has, it fools us initially as we start hearing the poem into thinking this is just like a nursery rhyme, this is going to be. But by the end, we've been identified not only with the victim but with the perpetrator, which is what we saw yesterday in the photography discussion, the refusal to let sharp dichotomies dictate what reality is. It's wonderful to say, I am not Hitler. And every college ethics class does that regularly. We point to that guy as this awful example. This poem refuses to let the one who names the evil exempt herself or himself from being the agent of the evil. And I think it's a wonderfully Lutheran poem in that regard. That is, it in the paradoxical understanding of Lutheran tradition, you cannot simply opt for the one side if you're going to talk, not dualism, but spectrum here. You can't say, I'm going to locate myself just on the evil end or just on the good end. So this poem has the effect of blurring every line that is posed by the world and its fear. I like the last stanza myself immensely, however. Anybody think of anything in particular listening to the old crone stuff? Any readers of Mary Daly?
Yeah.
It is, as a matter of fact, the first time I read this poem, I had a mental picture of Mary Daly in that last, in the last stanza. The crone is who? Recall offhand?
Remember.
Anybody recall? Crone? Crone used to be what kind of a word? It referred to what just in normal English, in everyday English? Did all girls say at the age of 6, I sure hope I can grow up to be a crone? No.
Isn't it an old maid?
An old maid, shriveled, asexual, physically weak but secretly strong, so you never know what she's going to do. She shows up as the witch in a lot of the bad witch. So what does Mary Daly do with that?
She makes her the most compassionate, the person who understands that there's this question hanging over
them. Mm-hmm. And Jane Flanders does it in the poem, and that's exactly what Mary Daly does. She says the crone is not this decrepit, dangerous to women. The crone is this powerful, old, wise woman who's dangerous to conventional knowledge. So, we can come back to any of these, but I'd like to have the bulk of the conversation with three in hand and in head. So I'll pass out the final one, which is a longer poem, print small, so if you can get in good light while you're sharing these copies. One of the things that the goddess, or Yahweh, or Kali, or whomever we're calling on, has done for us on the planet is to give us Joy Harjo, a poet to make you shiver in your boots. This is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window. She is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window. Her hands are pressed white against the concrete molding of the tenement building. She hangs from the 13th floor window in East Chicago with a swirl of birds over her head. They could be a halo or a storm of glass waiting to crush her. She thinks she will be set free. The woman hanging from the 13th floor window on the east side of Chicago is not alone. She is a woman of children, of the baby Carlos, and of Margaret and of Jimmy, who is the oldest. She is her mother's daughter and her father's son. She is several pieces between the two husbands she has had. She is all the women of the apartment building who stand watching her, watching themselves. When she was young, she ate wild rice on scraped down plates in warm wood rooms. It was in the farther north, and she was the baby then. They rocked her. She sees Lake Michigan lapping at the shores of herself. It is a dizzy hole of water, and the rich live in tall glass houses at the edge of it. In some places, Lake Michigan speaks softly. Here, it just sputters and butts itself against the asphalt. She sees other buildings just like hers. She sees other women hanging from many-floored windows, counting their lives in the palms of their hands, and in the palms of their children's hands. She is the woman hanging from the 13th floor window on the Indian side of town. Her belly is soft from her children's births. Her worn Levi's swing down below her waist, and then her feet, and then her heart. She is dangling. The woman hanging from the 13th floor hears voices. They come to her in the night when the lights have gone dim. Sometimes they are little cats mewing and scratching at the door. Sometimes they are her grandmother's voice. And sometimes they are gigantic men of light whispering to her to get up, to get up, to get up. That's when she wants to have another child to hold on to in the night, to be able to fall back into dreams. And the woman hanging from the 13th floor window hears other voices. Some of them scream out from below for her to jump. They would push her over. Others cry softly from the sidewalks, pulling their children up like flowers and gather them into their arms. They would help her like themselves. But she has the woman hanging from the 13th floor window, and she knows she is hanging by her own fingers, her own skin, her own thread of indecision. She thinks of Carlos, of Margaret, of Jimmy. She thinks of her father and of her mother. She thinks of all the women she has been, of all the men. She thinks of the color of her skin and of Chicago streets and of waterfalls and pines. She thinks of moonlit nights and of cool spring storms. Her mind chatters like neon and north side bars. She thinks of the 4 a.m. lonelinesses that have folded her up like death, discordant, without logical and beautiful conclusion. Her teeth break off at the edges. She would speak. The woman hangs from the 13th floor window, crying for the lost beauty of her own life. She sees the sun falling west over the gray plain of Chicago. She thinks she remembers listening to her own life break loose as she falls from the 13th floor window on the east side of Chicago, or as she climbs back up to claim herself again. So, initial reactions to Joy Harjo's poem.
It really has the feel of Chicago about it. If you've ever been there, it has that feel about it.
Yeah, she uses consonants in the poem nicely to do the edginess of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Other initial reactions.
It's kind of neat the way there's tension building through the whole thing, and you feel like she's got to let go at some point, kind of thing, and then within two lines of the end, she's fallen and gotten back up at the same time. And then you look back on the rest of the poem, and it's like that's kind of what's happening through the whole thing, too, that she keeps falling, but building herself back up, and that's why she hasn't fallen yet, but then eventually she will fall, and she will get back up.
That's a lovely insight into the poem. Really nice. I never thought of it quite that way. That's intriguing.
Do you, other initial, I want to come back and ask a question about that if I may, but I want to get some other initial responses.
She always lets you know where the woman is. You know, the woman's, I mean, it just repeats over and over again that she's hanging on the 13th floor window.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What feeling does that give you to hear that repeated again and again?
Suspense.
Suspense, so it's part of what builds the tension in the poem?
And also indecision on her part.
Also indecision. Yes.
It seems like they always say that when you die, your life comes before you, and you see your whole life, and she's kind of turning her life over, and it's attributes, and it's pain, and that's the cause of her indecision. She doesn't know whether to let go.
Mm-hmm. If there's pain in her life and she's in indecision, there must be other to other than the pain. What is that? What keeps her from jumping?
Well, it seems like she has hope. Even hanging from the windowsill.
Is there any part of the poem you might point to that you read as hope?
She repeats her children
mm-hmm.
often and her dreams. The voices in the stem that has done to hear the voices in the under room that have gone to other child that seems hopeful to me.
And what is that talking about, that stanza about the voices and the spirits?
They're sort of in the everyday and in the, it's sort of a mystical and magical poem because it's very much talking about the everyday and the ordinary, describing her in her warm blue eyes, then her feet and then her heart, there are turns like that, and you're seeing
you know, ordinariness, and yet it's very shocking.
Who in that next, and you're right, it's shocking just to think, and if you think literally, this woman is hanging from her fingertips. Her feet are down. Her Levi's slip first down past her waist, then past her feet, and then her heart, which is lower than her feet. It's a poignant image. In the next verse, who are these voices and men that she hears? Is it, what tradition, who is her community? American Indian. So what is going on here is a recollection of what? Said earlier in the poem. This is Chicago, so she probably grew up where?
Maybe on the reservation. Is there one?
Nope. Or? Look at 1, 2, 3, the fourth block down in the poem.
Wood rooms.
Mm-hmm. Wild rice on scraped down plates in warm wood rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Probably northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, it sounds like, the Northern Plains Indians. So what is she remembering when she remembers the spirits and the gigantic men of light? Native religion. So that's I think it's another element that enables her to hope, is that these gigantic men of light calling her to get up, to get up, to get up.
And then she wants to have another child.
Uh-huh. And how would that fit into that, to this Native tradition?
Well, continuing the ancestors, I mean, it's kind of going back to the ancestors, and that's, she wants to bring that spirit back in, to give birth to that spirit, maybe. I don't know.
I think we could pursue that. It certainly would be the case that if she kills herself, she's killing not only herself. Mm-hmm. To kill oneself is to break the line of the ancestors to the ancestors to the ancestors. So this poem is again saying, and it says it in many ways, you are never a self alone. That to be a person is to be part of a community, not to be an individual. And it's repeated in the poem quite frequently, this where she is first all the women and then all the men. The distinction of sexuality gets undercut here again, because there is an identification of the individual self with the whole community. And that brings me back, I want to pose the question before we take up some other themes back. I can't remember your name.
Sarah.
I couldn't remember because I didn't ever know it, I guess. Sarah, do you think that she jumped at the end or not?
I think she gives up hope and then regains hope.
So you read the ending as a recurring image. Right? And as you said before, you see that through the whole poem.
Sort of as, I mean, in the second block, she thinks she'll be set free, and in a way that's kind of, it's like, it goes both ways. You know, she experiences release because she kind of gives up, but then she keeps going because that's also being set free. So it's like double.
Mm-hmm. Nicely subtle reading of the poem. That doesn't mean there's only one subtle reading of the poem. There are many. How about the rest of you? Do you agree with that reading of the ending of the poem? And not to say that if you disagree, it's Sarah's is wrong, but how do you read the end of the poem?
I think she might have jumped. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the second paragraph, which is only one line, says she thinks she will be set free. Somehow, you know, she's dangling out this window. I would assume that she's dangling out the window because she thinks somehow that's going to set it free. So I think she may have jumped.
In order to obtain freedom?
Mm-hmm.
Any other clues in the poem that lead you to choose that over the other one? Other option?
Think about her listening to her own life break loose.
Four.
Yeah.
So there's one reading that says she jumped. Anybody think that she climbs back up instead of jumping? It's a third major option, isn't it? Sarah's is the first, that this is recurring and repetitive. Nobody thinks she simply climbs back up to claim herself again without jumping?
I get kind of the poem is written in omniscient third person, which then puts the onus on us. So it's neither. She neither falls nor gets up, but it's the ongoing life of the poem is in us. And our sharing with this woman, sharing the life of this woman with this woman while we're reading the poem and while we're experiencing with her.
I think I'd agree with that, because in the beginning she's a specific woman, but she's also all these other women and men who have had these same feelings, and at the end it's left with a choice, and there's choices all through the poem that she could choose life or she could choose this supposed escape, and at the end we're just left with that choice to turn over for ourselves and to realize that we could be in the same position.
Elizabeth. I think also that the verb to hang is there's a certain way of life where you feel like you're just hanging on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this woman probably has that kind of life. So that I read this, there's certainly that literal hang where she'll be hanging from a window. But also I could visualize it as an image of someone who stands in the window who has that kind of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In which case the question of whether she jumps or falls or climbs back up takes on a different tone. Is she able to survive?
Mm-hmm.
Does she
mm-hmm.
make it in this life? Which really makes a nice connection, I think, back to the first poem that you had us read about how the line between one kind of life and another kind of life dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
And then the verb to hang is also the one we use to talk about the crucifixion.
Sure is.
That Jesus hangs on the cross. So somehow I think the question about whether she jumps or not fades when I think about those considerations.
Okay, it's connected to, go ahead.
You see, I'm thinking I'm there but for the grace of God go I.
Yeah.
So this poet is giving me a chance. You know, that's a very difficult thing, to walk in somebody else's shoes. And we're always saying, well, you know, walk in their shoes for a while. Well, we don't ever do that. And I think it's just kind of a very neat way that this poet has let us walk in someone's shoes, even built up the suspense of being in this woman's situation. So that I agree with this gentleman here. He helped me think of what I just said. He helped me along. Because I think it's neither two, but I think he's trying to get us to kind of walk in her life for a moment.
She
really, and it's such an impossible thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And what, there's another, there's a really serious impediment to, for those of us in this room, to walk in this woman's shoes.
Oh.
And that really serious impediment is what?
She's Indian.
She's Indian, and we're, and that in and of itself, I mean, Indian and white, it's, what about that? Goes back to the Alice Walker short story. How do you deal with your own racism as you stand? And I think it's a very useful observation that we read this poem as an outside observer. Objective, perhaps, in a poetic sense. But as observers, how do you correct for your own racism as you read the poem? You thought about that?
I kind of feel like the author is almost pointing out that people can't because they're too involved in their own life, sort of like in the eighth part where the woman is hanging from the 13th floor and his voice is, some of them scream out from below for her to jump, they would push her over. Others cry softly from the sidewalk, pull their children up like flowers and gather them into their arms. They would help her like themselves. And it's like, only what you can relate to, like, you know, some people don't care because their life is too important to them, so they say jump, whatever. The other people say, oh no, don't, and then they clutch their own children because they think, you know, life is so precious and whatever they're thinking. And so the way that they relate to that is, no, don't jump because if it were me, I couldn't jump because my children are important to me. And so it's sort of as if we can't possibly, because we aren't this woman hanging from the window. We don't have any idea of what it's like to hang from a window, be an Indian woman in the life.
Empathy is something that is so difficult to do, and even if you live to be 90, you sometimes say, could I really have jumped? I think it's impossible for humans to really empathize. I think that word is untouchable. I think Christ maybe can, because they have the power to do that, their creator. But I think that word is the hardest word ever in the world. And so therefore, I really think that I don't know of any way to teach someone to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not that, I can't even pontificate on that.
Did you find, at the end of reading, hearing the poem, that your emotional state was different from what it usually is for middle-class whites? I don't want to ask the question more specifically because I'll answer it, I suppose. Did this poem move you in a way that that prose discourses on racism don't?
Well, I think that, just me personally, the tension that was built up that last, this could be extremely personally me. The first line of the last section, the woman hangs from the 13th floor, crying for the lost beauty of her own life. There was a tremendous, the tension and the building up and all that, and suddenly smack, that line is what I connected, my own heart felt when I read that, and suddenly, that line broke something for me. And then the paragraph became very personal, as to my own struggles and loss of beauty. So that line that we talk about, I think that's where it was crossed with myself.
Melted. To use the other
word. I'm going to admit something that's very difficult for me. But at the end of the LA riots, after I saw that man ask the people to stop, I realized I was born a racist. I never honestly ever took enough time to think of how bad I am. But he really made me that moment say that I was. And I never even wanted to think about whether I was or not. But I think that that's difficult, and I don't know what I can do about it, and that's frustrating. But to think that that horrible incident really did it for me is just, to me, mind-boggling. I don't. So in reading that, I'm afraid I slipped back in my old habits. My first thought was not race, and I had to think about it after people talked about it.
Well, I mean, conversion isn't instantaneous and forever. It comes in stages. I think it's wonderful that Rodney King's statement led you to that realization.
Well, I wonder how these younger people feel about that word. I guess I'd be interested in how they feel about where they're at.
That word being racism?
Yeah, how do you feel about
that? It's uncomfortable, but it's here, I can't escape it. And I'd rather be less racist than someone else, I guess, is how I try to approach it, but I hear a lot of people say, I'm not racist.
Well, I think we're all racists. I mean, the simple benefiting from the white. Inherently, we cannot be anything but until the whole structure, the whole system of...
But you felt that way for a long time? You didn't come to...
Oh, I was thrown into an urban studies program where I dealt with it. I mean, that it came into my head on my own, no. I was placed in this... I mean, I guess I'm very lucky to have that opportunity, but...
Well, you know, then when the realization is there, do you just take it for granted, or what do you do?
Well, Bev Harrison says that the only good question is one which has an action for an answer.
Yeah.
And I think she's right. And that means that you look first to your local community rather than global. You know the problem's global, but you look locally where you live. And try to discern what shape, what form, what human bodies racial injustice takes where you live. And if you don't know, then the first thing you do is find out. That's your first action, is the attack on your own ignorance, I would think. And I say you, because but it applies to everyone in the room. Where do you live?
Minnesota. St. Paul, Minneapolis, Rosedale, as a matter of fact, suburb.
Mm-hmm. Well, this could have been Minneapolis as easy as Chicago, this poem.
Maybe not.
Sure, she's hanging from the 13th floor of the Lutheran Brotherhood building.
Well, I think more it would be a poorer person, perhaps. Well, I don't think that would happen. I think last year there were 52 murders. There was 4 million people in our state and 2 million concentrated in the cities. I think so far this year, you know, even violence such as murder, that's why I mentioned it right away, because I just read a most recent statistic that there's, you know, we're into the year, it's June, and it's 12 murders, and I really try, I mean, when I think of what happens in New York, which is a, you know, a bigger city and compared to where I live, appreciating a minority group where I live, I mean, I perhaps would begin to appreciate Hmong people first before I got into the blacks or the Indians or Mexican people or the Orientals or Asian. I mean, you see, it really depends on where your orientation is, where, how, I hate to use the word sheltered, at living over 50 years, I mean, being that sheltered, but you can be that way. You can get in those lovely, comfortable, you know, pathways in your part of the world.
And a sheltered existence is possible because of what economic factors? Pardon?
Cars.
Interstates. South Central Los Angeles runs right between two big interstate systems. It's caught there economically. Sheltered is the word of the privileged. Naming our own interests, what benefits us, we say we are able to live a sheltered life. From the perspective of those who live in South Central LA, it's not sheltered, it's what? Segregated. Which is the same phenomenon viewed from the other perspective, yes, named from the other perspective.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And I know that Minneapolis is like that because I've been there.
Yeah.
And so is St. Paul. And if you take the greater metropolitan area and start looking, get a census map, and look where the ethnic groupings are, it's Minneapolis is about as segregated as Boston, and that's saying a lot. And but it's not only the murder rate, it's these unnamed, it's the unlabeled suicides that is really a better clue than the murder rate. The murder rate is class-induced stress very often, but the suicide rate is not hanging on anymore.
I don't wish to dominate.